Hello and welcome to What Screen, the horror movie podcast where I, your host, Egrain, chats with a special guest every week about horror films. And we talk about two films that have to do with a certain subject that I've previously randomly chosen. Now, this week's subject is so fucking apt. I didn't plan it. I have my recordings and I go week by week in whatever order I recorded them. And I don't know whether it was the gods of horror that aligned. But this week, okay, I'm in Rome. I am currently in Italy enjoying the magic of Rome. And the subject for this week's podcast is Italian horror. I mean, what are the freaking chances this would all add up? Anyway, sorry. There goes my excitement. This week is about Italian horror, which I freaking love. I love Italian horror with a passion. My special guest is Naomi, and together we are going to be talking about two films from Italy. The first one being The Cat and Nine Tails, directed by Dario Argento in 1971, whose museum, Profondo Rosso, I am going to be going to. And then our second film is Zombie 2, a 1979 zombie film directed by Lucio Fulci. So yes, enjoy our chat about Italian horror. So I would like to welcome to What a Scream, Naomi. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm very, actually, a little bit hungover, but you know. Oh well, I don't get out
that's
much.
That's what bank holiday weekends are for.
Well, it's not a bank holiday here in Ireland. It was last week was our bank holiday. So
that sucks. Why don't you get one? We should get one.
Well, I guess because ours is always falls on like the 1st of May around there. Whereas I think, did you get yours for the coronation?
Yeah, we get Monday for the coronation. So which I feel is perfectly justified.
So would you like to let listeners know who you are and what you do?
Sure. So my name is Naomi Roper, and in real life, I'm a lawyer, but I run a website called The Geek Goddesses, which you can find at thegeekgoddesses.com. And I am a horror reviewer and blogger. I mean, I do other things as well. I do a lot of photography, go to an awful lot of conventions and do write-ups about that. But horror really is my first love. So you'll mostly find my site is full of various different horror reviews, trying to get to as many horror film festivals as I can, and very much looking forward to Soho Horror Festival and Fright Fest later on this year.
Yes, because that is where we met originally at Fright Fest. And yes, I have all my stuff booked for Fright Fest, so I'm very excited. And then again for Soho again this year. So
cool.
So how did you get into horror, and what was the first horror film you ever saw?
See, I'm trying to I was always into horror. I think my parents were very enthusiastic about me reading. So I think I probably came into horror more via books than films initially, because I do have a very vivid memory of being asked to pick books for the library at school and then getting told off because I'd picked too many that were scary in their view. I remember sort of reading Joan Aiken and things like that when I was younger, and some of the sort of the comic strips and some of the stuff in Bunty and the likes of that were sort of horror adjacent at the time as well. And then in terms of horror films, it's really hard to sort of, because my parents aren't as much into films as I am. My father was always into sci-fi, so I was kind of raised on a diet of Star Trek, Star Wars, all the rest of it. But I'm thinking horror would probably be... See, The Lost Boys seems too late, but that was certainly fairly prevalent. The Neverending Story is incredibly horrifying, where the poor old horse dies or whatever it is. That was extremely distressing. But yeah, I think it sort of went into the sort of the mid-80s. I mean, I can't profess that I was busy watching 80s, you know, video nasties while I was a child, because I wasn't. But I think I kind of came into it via the likes of the books. And also you have to bear in mind that children's TV when I was growing up was weird. It was all things like the Demon Headmaster. There was Moondial, where they go back into the past. There was all kinds of things. There was like a one that was vaguely called Shadows or something that I remember, maybe Bleak Shadows, something like that. But Round the Twist, which was incredibly creepy and surreal. Horror at that time was children's TV had a really horrifying twist at that point. I remember there was a show called Dramarama where they did a different 45-minute episode every single week that was based on all kinds of different things. I remember very vividly one on child abuse. And there was one where everyone had died from being given lead painted toy soldiers. And they all came back to life. So yeah, this was the kind of stuff that was being served up to us at what, 5 o'clock at night on BBC One for us all to watch. And we were all like, okay, this is fun. And no one batted an eyelid. And I do feel sad for the kids today that there is really is no children's programming anymore. Unless, you know, it's the streamers that provide all the content for the kids now. But yeah, back in the old days, the BBC was providing a whole variety of things like Eerie Indiana, things like that for us to watch. And I think that sparked my interest from a young age.
Yeah, I would have been the same as you, coming at it from a book origin, like very into my gothic novels and of course Goosebumps and
Now
true.
you see, I seem to have completely missed Goosebumps because
Really?
I appear to have been, I don't know, either the wrong age or it just didn't hit the sunny climes of Slough. But Goosebumps entirely passed me by. So I have never really read any of them. I've seen the Jack Black film, but I've not read any of them. Christopher Pike, certainly. And I started recollecting the old Christopher Pikes with all the beautifully lurid things, and I started rereading them the other day, and it was quite. I mean, obviously, they were later than I remembered, so I was kind of a later teenager when they were all out initially, because they are all sort of late 80s, early 90s, and they're very, you know, they are very fat phobic, they are very loose with the homophobic slurs here and there, but they are also go quite hard for something that was based at children, effectively. You know, kids are dying left, right, and center, and nobody seemed to bat an eyelid. So yes, Christopher Pike was quite an important part of my teenage years.
Yeah, for me as well, Are You Afraid of the Dark was a big TV show for me when I was younger, and it was like played on a Saturday morning, 10 a.m., and you're just like, how? Like you said, yeah.
I've heard of that, but I remember in the mornings would always be things like Muppet Babies, and then you'd have Going Live and all the rest of it. But I don't remember Are You Afraid of the Dark? But yes, children's TV was wild in those days. There was so much gothic, creepy, and very English horror around, but which we just seem to have just lost. Well, I suppose Stranger Things is the equivalent now, which is big and glossy and in its own way a kind of a revamp of the Amblin, Eerie Indiana style tales of the 80s. But yeah, the programming that the BBC was churning out at 5 o'clock on a weekday evening was extraordinary if you look back at it.
So let's crack on with our theme then for this episode, which is Italian horror. Now I know this isn't a strong point of yours, but what do you know about Italian horror? Are you a fan of what you've seen so far?
So yes, I have to be honest, I am a bit of a newbie when it comes to Italian horror. I have seen, obviously I've seen Suspiria, which I think is wonderful, and I've seen the remake, which I think is overlong but has some beautiful scenes and some beautiful qualities to it, although it doesn't hold a candle to the original. But in terms of Italian horror in general, yes, I know very little. Giallo, I've struggled with. Because it's just incredibly silly. I try, but it's just so silly. It's all very slow and ponderous and beautifully shot and incredibly stilted. And sometimes the deaths are great, and sometimes the deaths are pretty much what you would see in your average BBC adaptation of Agatha Christie. And yes, it's always very stylish. Everyone looks good, even though, of course, when we look back, whenever it's always very funny whenever we look to recreate the 70s or the 80s, we always come up with the most beautiful colors. Whereas, of course, when you actually see these films, everyone's very beige and brown. It's just a sea of dull colors. And like, if you get the women in pretty colors, they're in like the worst pastels you've ever seen. So yes, I don't know a great deal about Italian horror. I would know Argento. I probably would be quite poor in terms of naming other Italian horror directors. So yes, this is all a bit new to me.
So for me, I am a fan of Giallo. I prefer the nastier end of Giallo. I know a lot of it. One of the films we're going to talk about today is quite, it can be really boring. And it can be just like a, almost like a Hitchcock knockoff.
Yeah.
But I do enjoy good Italian gore, like especially when we get onto Eye Trauma, which is like seems to be
Oh, yes,
their
goodness.
pinnacle.
Ooh, they're
And
very
yeah,
keen on it.
they are. So yeah, I'd be quite a fan. Yes, it's hilariously silly at points, but for me, I just kind of lean into that sometimes, and I just think, yes, it's so stupid. Like some of the dialogue, some of the plot points, I'm just like, this is ridiculous, but I'm gonna lean into it. So yeah, I'd be quite a fan. I wouldn't say I was like an expert at Italian horror, but I'm definitely like a fan. So let's chat about the first film then. Would you like to introduce it and give us a brief synopsis, please?
Yeah, so I saw The Cat of Nine Tails by Dario Argento.
Lori, I want you to take a look and tell me who you see in that car we just passed.
There's a man with brown hair. There's somebody else too, but I can't see his face. He's dead. The man you told me to look at the other night. Scientist crushed by train.
I'd like to talk to you about the death of Dr. Calabresi.
Our photographer even managed to get a shot of the action.
It's as if somebody had pushed the poor bastard out of the train.
My friend, the photographer, he's dead.
It's sort of a slightly more horrific Agatha Christie type Hitchcock knockoff tale. I mean, effectively, it starts with the two main characters are a blind gentleman who is quite inappropriately called throughout Cookie because he has a wild, well, what seemed to me to be wildly inappropriate relationship with a little girl who seems to be forever sitting on his knee, who is an orphan that he appears to have adopted, but I was side-eyeing it the entire way through. And he's a reporter called Giordano, who is very handsome and cannot act to save his life. He is a beautiful walking Ken doll. It's very much this Ken solves murders. And Cookie, on the way home one day with his slightly dubious ward, hears somebody talking about blackmail in a car. And then the next thing you know, they're at this science institute where something has been stolen or not stolen. It's not very clear. And then, of course, the gentleman who is talking about blackmail is all like, "I'm going to go meet this mysterious person. I'm going to get my money, and nothing is ever going to happen to me." And 3 seconds later, he's horribly dead. And that sets the pattern for the rest of it, where people just keep dying in not tremendously gory ways, and Giordano and Cookie are investigating these deaths. Not very successfully, it has to be said. It takes them a very long time to get to a conclusion because there is a very limited pool of suspects in this film and one very obvious red herring. But I just enjoyed, I mean, it's quite slow for an hour and 45-minute film. And the deaths are quite weak. They are with the sort of the cat of nine tails and a lot of these garrots. I was like, you know what? If you put a bit of effort into it, I'm fairly sure you could have escaped that. There's really not a great deal to be done here. But it's the sort of movie where the person's like, I know who the killer is. Great, tell us. No, I'm going to write it down on a note that I'm going to secrete somewhere. And then I'm going to come tell you and give you the note, except I'm not, because I'm going to get murdered. And then you're going to lose the note. I don't think the note ever actually comes off at the end of it. Their whole thing is about this note, which never actually comes to fruition. But yes, it's incredibly slow, but there's so much in it that is fascinating. What I loved is that it is populated with these little side beats, these characters that just kind of waft in and out of the narrative for no real reason. So, like, there's the copper that just keeps popping up with samples of his wife's recipes. And everyone's like, no, don't shut up. I'm trying to solve a murder. I don't want to hear about your wife's ravioli. And I'm like, no, actually, I do want to hear about your wife's ravioli. That sounds fascinating. Tell me more. And he pops up twice. Then there's, is it Gigi the loser, who is
He's my
terrible.
favorite.
He's, yeah, some sort of terrible, like, guy that obviously is, who is obviously cool every time he tries to do anything, hence Gigi the loser, but is like the worst criminal in the world and can break into things. And at one point, our pretty little Ken doll gets him to break into the boss of the Science Institute's house, where we find a diary, which also doesn't play out. But he's just, it's just the most fascinating performance because he is giving his all in these few scenes. And he's like, no, I'm going to get caught. I'm a total loser. Anything we do, I'm cursed. And it's like, and I think that's one of the problems with the film is that everyone surrounding the main duo is much more interesting than they are. And so you have these small characters wandering in and out of the narrative. There is the sex kitten, sort of daughter of the main head of the Science Institute, who is, I mean, it's also, it's hilarious. She's a hugely stilted performance. She is this, she has like, I don't know when this was made. It must have been like late 70s, but she has this like stunning sort of Farrah Fawcett
Yeah, it was
wave.
1971,
Wow. Okay. So
which
early.
her hairstyle surprised me in this. I am going to
Yeah,
say that.
because it is full. I mean, to the extent there were quite a lot of points where I was like, is this a lace front? That's the lace front wig that some hairdresser has just gone wild with. But she has like these cascading waves, and she's in like pastels or huge chains, very Italian makeup. At one point, she has the worst sex scene I have ever seen.
She looks so bored in it.
Yeah, it's I sort of feel like that was the best take Argento could get, and that worried me because she and Giordano have zero chemistry anyway. I mean, he's beautiful, but he's somehow actively off-putting. There is no sexual charge to him whatsoever. He's just there. And then they have this sex scene, which in one of the most amazing things I've ever seen, her dress is Velcroed. She rips off the dress in 3 seconds flat to reveal she's completely nude underneath. And this always fascinates me as well, because we'll talk about that in your film as well when we get to it. Italian horrors tend to feature very buxom ladies with no kind of harnessing going on. And look, those boobs wandering around free, that's not comfortable. That's going to give you tremendous backache. So, I appreciate if you've gone over to Giordano's for the sole purpose of having sex, you might want to be naked underneath, but I still don't feel it would be comfortable. So yes, she whips off her dress with Velcro fastenings and then lies down with all the enthusiasm of someone who is going to a dental appointment, and he climbs on top of her, and it's literally the worst thing ever. Gigi the loser, I loved him. He's introduced as part of an insult contest, which again, fascinating. I want to know more about the insult contest. Who decided this was a thing that two guys would insult each other, and whoever comes up with the most creative ones wins? That's brilliant. But there is, and it's just everyone is more interesting than the main duo. There's a scientist called Braun, Very broad strokes there, a German scientist called Braun, and who is gay and goes to a club, which a very uncomfortable Giordano wanders around going, oh my God, there are guys dressed up as women. It's all very, very broad, but he was fascinating, as was the guy who is furious that Braun has stolen his boyfriend. So there was all these little things going on in the background, but the central duo have no chemistry, no relationship whatsoever. They're just there. They're just the fulcrum that all these other activities are sort of flowing around. I mean, at one point, this, and it all hinges on this, which I think in the 1970s was solid science and has now been disproven, which is that the suggestion that you can attempt to find who people are going to be more violent or have a tendency towards criminal activity from their genes. And I believe that's now been debunked as utter nonsense, but that's what this is all focused on. And at one point, one of the scientists goes, so we're going to do this test, and then we're going to round up all the kids that have it and shove them somewhere. And Giordano doesn't even take a beat, doesn't blink at this notion of the mass incarceration of tiny children. Because he's just like, yeah, that's fine. Eugenics, no worries. Sounds good to me. So yeah, it takes a very long time to get going. There are a lot of deaths, but they are quite tame deaths. They're quite tame.
Yeah. I mean, I would say on the scale of Giallo, this is definitely a tamer one. And for me personally, it's definitely not one of my favorite Argento films. He has done so many better giallos. Even his first one, Bird with a Crystal Plumage, is just so much better. And it amps up the tension. There's no tension in this film. That's what the problem is. There's no tension. And I found myself drifting, like when I was watching this, just like,
well, he tries to build the tension by just basically having the strings just go in every scene. And after a while, that just gives you a headache. And then the repeated motif of the killer's eye, this sort of, which again is a cheat because it's like this orangey yellow eye that never plays into anything, but that is constantly there. And I feel like there were ways to go that would have made this more interesting. He actually drops more interesting plot points as he's going through. It's fairly obvious who, you know, that it has to be one of the scientists as the killer. And so you've such a limited pool. And I feel that there were more opportunities and options available in terms of, you know, some sort of last minute twist, but there's not. I liked the last scene where the killer falls down the lift shaft and you see his hands scorching as he tries to cling to the thing. But yes, the difficulty is, as you said, there's no tension. And the two guys just, you know, they don't vibe off each other. The cookie daughter relationship is really uncomfortable all the way through. She's dressed as this tiny little girl. And I suspect she was probably older. But it all just keep going, cookie, cookie. It's just like, no, I'm not liking this at all. This is inappropriate. I do not care for it. And the sex kitten daughter basically just being, look at me, I'm a nympho red herring, come fuck me. Whilst simultaneously also at the same time being as bored as she possibly could be. I think the scene that completely took me out of it was the milk.
Yeah. Like,
so, I mean, I was just like, I couldn't get to grips with the logic of it at all. So he gets his milk delivered in like these milk packets. And then he offers this as a drink to the woman he's just had sex with. So this milk has been sat outside all day, presumably his apartment. He's not refrigerated it. Who is touching warm, unrefrigerated milk? Who is offering this?
That has also been pierced. So, you know, he lays it down on the table and it's spilled because it's been pierced by a needle with drugs. And surely, if you pick the sachet up and you're like, oh, it's spilled, there must be a puncture in this milk. I cannot drink this milk. It's been spoiled. But no, he goes ahead and he pours it and then somehow gets a realization that it's poisoned.
I think Giordano, bless him, is just incredibly dim. which is why he apparently he picks up one of the sachets that hasn't been pierced, and then realizes eventually, very slowly, that the other one has been. But it takes him forever, to the extent that the poor actress is literally having to hold it, doing slow incremental movements towards her mouth, because you have to build tension, but there is none, because she would have downed half the glass by now. But yes, that was, as a method of, that was one of the weirder choices I felt that Argento and the scriptwriter make, which is to have the attempted murders of both parties. Giordano's is on screen and Cookie's is off screen. Cookie just says, oh, they tried to kill me with gas or something. And I was like, well, why is that not a crucial part of it? Surely having a blind man potentially be at risk would be a huge tension-inducing scene, and you just throw it away like it's nothing. It's just, he literally phones it in. It's a reference in a phone call to Giordano.
So Dario Argento originally wrote the screenplay with Dardano Sacchetti, mm-hmm. But then Dario Argento, in the most diva-ish way, went, actually, I don't need you. I'm just going to use my screenplay. And like sent him on his way. And because Argento's father was the producer on this film, poor Sacchetti didn't get anything from it. But it makes me wonder, would it have been a better film if they had continued doing the screenplay together? Rather than just Dario taking over everything.
Is there such a decent core here, even if it is a very familiar beat that's been told plenty of times, but the deaths aren't particularly inventively staged, and he doesn't appear to have had the best crop of actors on this one. All the decent actors appear to be in the little side roles. I mean, like the guy who is devastated that Braun has stolen his boyfriend, that's like one tiny scene and he's giving it his all, but he's just got this pretty himbo in the lead, and this slightly off-putting is Carl Malden, isn't it? Is Cookie. And they don't quite, yes, they are not bringing their A game.
No, not at all. So Dario Argento has this running theme in his films where it's like, you're not seeing the full picture. And in this film, he does it literally because he uses a blind person as one of the characters. And it's something he repeated again for Dark Glasses. I don't know if you watched that at Fright Fest.
I did watch Dark Glasses at Fright Fest. I found that quite fascinating because it was an interesting gendered response to that. And was that not everybody, and I should say that, but quite a lot of the guys were coming out going, that was great. And every woman was coming out going, okay, so the uppity whore gets punished by being blinded because she wouldn't fuck a John, and then basically is humiliated, degraded, and everything else throughout the remainder of the film before being left blind and utterly alone.
Yeah, I had the same reaction as you to it.
I mean, it's a nastier one and an interesting approach, and I feel like there could have been an interesting take with having an unlikable woman in a profession that doesn't garner respect, like prostitution, as the central figure. But she's a fucking bitch. And the whole uppity whore gets punished thing was just felt really cliche.
Yeah. 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 I kind of feel like I am a fan of Argento, and I do think he has a lot of pluses for him, especially when we talk about his queer representation, and especially back in the 70s when he was showing these queer spaces and queer people, and he's not as exploitative about it as you would expect from a 70s director. But yeah, sometimes when they're like, you know, some of your films are a little bit misogynistic, and you're kind of like, I see it in Cat and Nine Tails, just because the women are just complete, there's no character to them.
Yeah, they're nothing. I mean, she's there to look, because there's two, isn't there? There's basically the sex kitten and the shrew, and the shrew is very dim. She effectively causes her own death. She could have saved herself multiple times, and There was something much more interesting hinted in relation to the sex kitten in terms of the possibility of her having caused her parents' deaths, in terms of her perhaps being the maniac with this XXY chromosome. And then I was a little surprised he didn't take that route, which was much more interesting, even if that would have been obvious and cliche and possibly leaning into the misogyny of it. At least that would have been more interesting than the random guy.
Yeah, I agree with you there that I think if it had at least been her, it would have been more of a thing like, which he's explored in stuff like Deep Red, you know, don't discount women because, you know, you think they're this certain way, but they could actually be this, you know, certain way. And I think even if they'd gone towards, oh, she's like a psychopath, that would have explained perhaps her sex reaction, because you're like, well, maybe she doesn't feel anything, you know, in that kind of typical, this is what a psychopath is, which you would have expected for the 70s. But yeah, it was just like all the women in this film were so just disposable and like ephemeral, and it was just like, yeah. And then you would have hoped that he would have like learned something about that, but then with like dark glasses it was just kind of like, oh dear.
I was also deeply confused in this film because she's been adopted by...
That was another thing, yeah.
...head of the Institute. But all of a sudden at the end, Giordano basically says she's sleeping with him, as far as I could see. And so I was like, well, I was getting so confused because there's no hint of that any all the way through, possibly because no one in the cast has any chemistry with anyone else in the cast. But there are no signs that she is having sex with him. She and Giordano have this really odd conversation where she's like, oh yes, as soon as you found out about me, of course it was me, when she's calling him out for blaming her or suggesting that she's the killer. But I'm like, well, hang on a minute, are you sleeping with him? Because there's never really been any indication of that so far. If you are, then he is sleeping with his adopted daughter that he adopted when she was what, early teens?
Yeah, 14, yeah. Yeah, it's so weird because they find the, him and Gigi find the diary when they break into your man's house, and it's like, I've adopted this daughter and now I think she's really beautiful and now I want to sleep with her and now I love her and she doesn't love me. And you're like, where is this coming from and why is this film full of inappropriate men?
Yeah, because that was... And I felt that, and again, that just isn't really leaned on at all, because of course, if he adopted her and groomed her and has been sleeping with her since she was 14, that's atrocious. But that just sort of gets mentioned in like 2 seconds, and then we move on. I mean, to the extent that I was almost confused as to whose diary it was, whether it was her father's diary or her adopted father's diary, because they don't make that hugely clear. But yeah, if she's been sleeping with him since she was presumably adopted, well, that's rape, sweetheart. And has been for ever since she was a kid.
Yeah, like, but that's some like Woody Allen type shit going on right now.
Well, like, it's just the fact that that just gets sort of tossed off. And then there is seemingly no repercussions for that. She presumably just goes back to sleeping with her adopted father, who presumably controls her money and therefore is effectively keeping her as kind of a sex slave in this house. If he's got all the money and all the purse strings and everything else, because he says that, I think at one point he says he likes to keep her close. And I was like, oh, we've sort of done this fun ending where we're like, oh, hey, the killer's gone, woohoo. And I'm like, hang on a second, we doing something about this guy? We gonna do anything about the guy that's banging his adopted daughter and is keeping her as like a kept woman in the house? No? Okay, yeah. Then let's move on. I was a bit blown away by that because It's done in such a way that you feel that Argento wants sympathy for Giordano for having been the one to wrongly accuse her and for how over the top her reaction is to it. But hang on a minute, guys, are we not, like, we're just leaving one of the biggest things here?
Yeah, yeah. It's such a shame because, like, when Dario Argento gets it right, he gets it so right. Like, amazing. But then obviously when you've got this, and you know, I wasn't a fan of Dark Glasses and stuff like Giallo, it's just kind of like he gets it so wrong as well, and it's heartbreaking for a fan.
This is just a it's just a film with really inappropriate sort of father-daughter relationships, really.
So I take it you wouldn't recommend it to horror fans then?
I mean, I feel like if you can watch the dub, which isn't too bad, and you want it as sort of entertaining background noise, and you want to, you know, improve, you know, your knowledge of the area, because I don't know anything about Giallo, so it's always good to, they can't all be winners. It's always good to see the rough with the smooth. I feel that it's not a bad film to watch. It's probably like a 2-3 star. I mean, it's, as I said, it's sort of a slightly more sex. It's like one of these new dark versions of Agatha Christie that the BBC keeps putting out for people in their 60s to wring their hands about. So, you know, it's basically Agatha Christie with a little bit of tits and some slightly silly deaths. So I feel if you can watch the dub and you're not having to give it your full attention, or if you're just like a completist and you really want to make sure that you've captured everything, all of Argento's work, then definitely. But otherwise, probably not going to be the one to seek out. What should they seek out, do you think? Because I do not know this, so I would love to hear.
Argento-wise, yeah. Or for Argento-wise, I definitely say Deep Red and Tenebrae is one of my current favorites. But also to start off with Bird with the Crystal Plumage, because that was his first kind of feature length giallo, and it's really good. It, like, it's really stylish. It's very weird. and yeah, but if you want to go full on crazy Argento, I'd definitely go with like Tenebrae or
I haven't Deep seen Red. That one. I've seen Deep Red, which is very colorful and very over the top. I've seen Deep Red and Suspiria, but that's about my limit.
Go with Tenebrae. Tenebrae is a bit cool. It's on Shudder as well, so easy.
Excellent.
So let's move on to my choice of film. I have been dying to cover this film. I chose 1979's Zombie 2, directed by Lucio Fulci.
Ahoy there! This is the Harbor Patrol. Anyone on board?
Yes, she looks abandoned.
One more step and I'm going to blast you. Now freeze where you are.
Yes, it's my father's boat.
And how long since you last spoke to him?
Well, we have to go to Matul. We're trying to locate Anne's father. She hasn't heard from him for some time.
That's not a cool place to hit.
I'm going to tell everyone that you're the one who's crazy. Demented, cruel, evil.
What exactly did my father die of, Dr. Minoy? And the boat's crew, what happened to them?
What is about the dead coming back to life again and having to be killed a second time?
Greed, violence, fantastic legends, voodooism, zombies.
And it was originally meant to be a sequel to George A. Romero's Dawn of the Dead, but it was rejected, which I can kind of see why, but it's still great. So it opens on, there's like, it opens on the New York Harbor, and there's an abandoned boat, and harbor patrolmen go on and they're attacked by a zombie. And it then goes back to this woman whose father owns the boat, but he is missing in an island called Matul, and her and a journalist go and try to find him. And when they get to the island, it turns out that her father is like a patient and kind of like a test subject for this doctor and his wife, who have been studying reanimation and zombies. And it turns out the island of Matul has been cursed by a voodoo curse, which causes zombies to come back. And yeah, it's pretty well. I love it for the gore. I like the peak of eye trauma, like Italian eye trauma.
That scene is savage. So I watched it shortly before we came on here, and for the first time, I had never seen it before. Now I had seen the eye scene before, because I've I feel like that must pop up on all of the sort of the horror clip shows. What I think so savage is how unbelievably slow that scene is.
Unflinching, slow, doesn't turn away at any point. You expect it to, but it does not. Like, that's, I think that's a real Fulci thing, is that he just does not look away. He really forces literally into your face. I have a special relationship with this film, and it's funny because this is very similar to my first experience with Suspiria. I'm going to blame this on Channel 4, because Channel 4 is to blame for a lot of children accidentally seeing horror films.
There were a lot of films. I was thinking about this the other day. There were quite a lot of films around, and I was going to say late night, but they couldn't have been that late because we didn't go to bed that late. So they must have been on like about 9 o'clock at night on like BBC and all of them. Because I was thinking back to a lot of the lurid erotic thrillers that I happened to just like randomly catch. But yeah, there was a lot of horror that used to be on the mainstream channels.
Yeah. And I caught this as a child, and I caught that particular scene, the eyeball scene, as a child. And I had the exact same experience with Suspiria, that I caught one of the scenes, you know, where like her eyes are bleeding and everything. It's just, woo.
Yeah.
I caught that as a child as well. And for years, these two scenes have been like imprinted in my little child brain. And it's only been in recent years that I've been like, that's that film. So yeah, zombie, again, imprinted in my brain before I'd even seen a full horror film. I'd seen like this scene. But yeah, so what did you think of it? What was your overall opinion on it?
I thought it was quite fascinating. I loved the beginning and end scenes, which I sort of felt like if they'd had a bit more money, this would have been like the most banging blockbusters. I mean, the beginning and end sequence, I thought it was fascinating that they choose to reference so many different nationalities when they're all Italian. So like the journalist is British, they've got American people, everyone is Italian. We're clearly, you know, why are you even doing this? But I loved the opening shot in the New York Harbor. It still sends shivers to see the Twin Towers. It's still really upsetting. And the end sequence of the zombies sort of shambling over the Brooklyn Bridge is just like the most beautiful cinematic shot, I thought. I thought it was, I mean, I much preferred this to Cano 9 Tales. I think that it builds really quickly at the beginning, and then when they reach the island, it dips for a really significant period because it just suddenly, the pace of it crawls to a halt until all of a sudden it's just like pure zombie madness everywhere. The zombies are very slow. I have to feel like some of these people could have escaped if they were really putting their mind to it, because they were clearly very strong, but very, very slow. I liked how gooey the zombies were. The makeup work is beautiful. It's incredibly lurid and grim. And obviously the famous shot of the zombie with the worms was great. Everyone on the island is horrible. All the non-zombie people. These are all terrible human beings. Wife, what are you doing there? Just get on a boat and leave. Come on. Why are you whining to your husband? And there's this whole sequence where she's in the shower. I don't know if she's crying or masturbating or what she's doing before the zombie gets her. But I was like, no, just leave. Just leave. You can clearly see that he's an absolute raving madman. Just go. Just go somewhere else. Don't stay on the cursed island. And then it all goes horribly wrong. And the daughter of the doctor who was on the island in the first place, her method of acting appeared to be to sort of just put her eyes very, very big. She just spends all of it like this. But we really have to talk about the shark zombie fight.
Yes, of course.
And most importantly, the nude scuba diving.
Right. So watching that again, I was like, that's not comfortable, because you've got a big ass heavy thing on your back that's dragging on your chest. That's not comfortable. It's not safe. There are loads of sea creatures down there, like jellyfish, possibly stuff that stings. And like, no, that's just not a thing. I'm sorry. That's a woman would not do that.
When she put, I don't think I have ever seen a scene that was more clearly written and conceived by men than when she goes over backwards with her tits flopping everywhere. Because these are not, look, modern cinema, it's quite rare nowadays that you've got an actress that's much more than an A cup, to be frank. These lucky ladies can wander around with whatever they want. They want to do nude scuba diving. It's probably not going to impact them. And if you've seen the Kristen Stewart one where she's trapped on the rig, the underwater rig, she spends the entirety of it in basically a white tank and nothing else. It's completely see-through because, and it's great. She's flying everywhere because bless her, she's a member of the Itty Bitty Titty Brigade. So she doesn't have to worry about having to wander around with infrastructure. This poor woman is clearly like a D or E cup. We're going nude scuba diving in, well, she's wearing a thong, which at one point when they drag her out of the water, you can see it cutting into her when they drag her backwards. It was the most, she's literally got a mark on her backside. It was the worst thing I've ever seen. That poor, poor actress must have been horrendously uncomfortable. There is no woman in the world that even, unless it's like a very, very, very specific fetish, goes scuba diving topless in a thong.
Yeah, it's just not believable. It's not feasible. Yeah, no.
It doesn't even make a great shot. Like if he wanted her, surely there were other opportunities. I mean, she's a very beautiful woman. Surely there were other opportunities if they wanted basically to have that scene. Because a lot of the 70s and 80s stuff were all about basically just getting the tits out in a sequence for the lads. And that's fine. You know, we can't dismiss that. A lot of scream queens made their careers on that and made very good money from it. So I have no issue with it. But surely there was a better way to showcase this beautiful actress. And by strapping a hugely uncomfortable thing to her back, I mean, she must have been miserable. She must have been utterly miserable. Her back must have been marked to hell.
Yeah. So she dives down and she's taking pictures of fish. And then this shark comes and she's like, shark.
That was a very cool shot, by the way.
It was. The only thing that I was like, when the shark bumps into the boat and I'm like, that shark isn't big enough to cause that much of a fucking ricochet off a boat. Like, that's just, no. And then she's trying to hide from this shark and we see this zombified hand come up and grab her. And it turns out there's a zombie at the bottom of the ocean. And then the shark and the zombie get into a wrestling match.
And it's very, the initial zombie attack is also done in a very sexual way because he's right between her legs while she's trying to escape him. So that's very purposefully framed in that way. So that was quite unpleasant as well. So you've got this topless woman now being with a zombie between her legs. But she escapes from that pretty quickly. And then the zombie and the shark fight. And I wanted the entire movie to be about zombie shark fights.
Yeah. Yeah, I just wish we'd had a bit more of an extension on that.
I want to see the zombies fighting other sea creatures. Zombie octopus fight.
Zombie squid.
Yes.
Apparently it was the shark wrangler who played that zombie. So amazing. He could like train the shark. Yeah, it's a wild scene. I'm happy for its inclusion.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, that's even more impressive if it's actually real, because you're never sure with these things. Did they just find a tank and film? Was anyone actually in that tank with the shark?
Yeah. Yeah. Also, how do you train a shark? I would have thought they were one of the animals that are like untrainable.
Oh, well, I mean, I suppose they can be trained with food, I guess, but that's a very dangerous thing. Never get them to associate humans with food.
Yeah, no. So what did you think of, because obviously when we see Romero's zombies, it's kind of ghoul zombies. It's not like the traditional sense of zombies that were like, you know, the Haitian voodoo or voodoo, that kind of tradition, whereas this kind of marries the pair of them. Do you think it was quite an exploitative take on the Haitian zombie, or do you think it was quite successful in its combination?
I think the thing is, whenever you are taking because obviously Hoodoo and Voodoo are two separate religions, but they are obviously there are very strong adherents to them across the world, and there still continues to be. And whenever you are taking that as a backdrop to something, particularly if you have no real involvement or you don't have somebody who is particularly well versed in it on the set, then you are just using it as set dressing. I mean, one of my favorite films, which is more and more upsetting the more you think about it, is The Skeleton Key, which does precisely this. It takes Hoodoo and uses it as a sort of a backdrop, although that does go into a more interesting discussion about race relations in the United States. Mm-hmm. But whenever you are taking something like Haitian voodoo and then just using it in a film like that, it's always going to be kind of not really appropriate. And just like in the same way, and there's one of the Bonds, isn't there, that's famous for this, where it also uses voodoo. Mm. But at the same time, you know, I suppose at the time when you're just, I mean, he was just looking to do a cool zombie flick, and I get that. So I feel like we can always go, yes, no, obviously, this probably wasn't hugely respectful. It probably wasn't respectful to the proponents and practitioners of the religion, which is actually a peaceful religion, I believe. Very peaceful. It's all about nature and our sort of how we interact with it. But, you know, as a backdrop to a zombie movie, it's very cool. And I presume there was a budgetary thing as well, getting them on an island. I mean, it's always basically when you are using, particularly as well, using Black people as the magic props mm-hmm. in your horror telling. It's not great. I mean, but then we've been doing that for years. And I suppose mm-hmm. it's only recently we've realized, oh, no, we probably shouldn't do that. Mm. But I can see for a 1970s shot film that needed to have zombies and wanted to have something that wasn't, that was a little bit different from Romero, that distinguished itself from that kind of a zombie outbreak that needed to have a reason behind it, than having a voodoo curse was a clever idea.
Yeah, I mean, it was the 70s, so, but at least there wasn't, you know, that cringe scene of locals dancing around a fire and, you know,
yeah, I actually thought from that perspective it wasn't too bad, because usually these things are terrible. They will depict the locals as savages that need to be civilized, and it didn't really have that. Like, everybody there was either a boat captain or part of the medical staff. There was no sort of, they often have like the local peasants, don't they, wandering in, that are all like, there's normally somebody to tell them dire warnings about what's going on so that we can mock them for their terrible beliefs and how savage they are. But there was none of that, probably because it didn't have time. It just gets straight on with the bangers. Just get straight on with it. But there are none of the, as you said, the cliches of that kind of a movie. There was no chanting or that, though there are, the zombies do make noises, don't they? They make odd sort of like chittering noises, but there was no chanting, no fires, no mumbo jumbo ceremony where, you know, everyone is usually hugely offensive by just making up the words. There was none of that. So from that perspective, wasn't too bad.
So would you recommend it to horror fans?
Oh yeah, definitely. I think the opening and ending shot are hugely atmospheric in terms of sort of the attack on New York. I think once it gets to the island, the pace of it dips a lot, but the makeup work is astounding. The eye trauma scene is horrifying. It's a bit narratively choppy once they reach the island. There's one sequence where they decide to have a bit of a nap on the island, which I'm like, why are we napping when it's so obvious there's going to be zombies buried 3 feet away from you? And funnily enough, there was.
They're like, let us just nap in this conquistador graveyard just here, because it just seems like the perfect spot to get a bit of shut eye.
Yes, and I suppose that in itself was, I mean, I guess a commentary in that the conquistadors just came and tried to civilize everybody and conquered effectively. But yes, that was hilarious. I was like, why are you so stupid, Blondie? Why are we having a little bit of a snooze on this clearly cursed island? You should have arrived, taken one look and gone, nope, getting back on the boat. Thanks very much. But yeah, I think it's, I had never seen it. And I'm very pleased I did see it. I'm glad you answered at the beginning why it was Zombie 2, because I was so confused because there didn't seem to be any prequel to it. But now I understand why. I think it's fantastic. I think it's certainly slow zombies, but strong zombies. So they're still quite menacing.
Yes. I love it because it's just an example of Fulci's kind of, you know, Dario Argento was called like the maestro of terror and Fulci was called like the maestro of gore when it came to like, you know, the big three Italian, him, Fulci, Argento and Bava, they all have like maestro of something. So yeah, it's a really good example of why he is the maestro of gore because of just this unflinching, you know, look at relatable trauma, which I think is another thing of Italian horror, is like real relatable trauma where you're like, oh, I can feel that.
And the blood, I mean, the blood is fascinating because it's not, it's too red and orangey to look realistic, but there is gallons of it and everything. It's a very squishy film. It's a very squishy, wet, squelchy film. All these zombies are disgusting. They're all
it's believable, isn't it? Like, you know, sometimes when you see zombies and you're like, they haven't been in the ground, you know, they do not look like they've been in the ground. They do not look dead. But this one, you're like, yeah.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, because generally speaking, to do zombie makeup is quite difficult unless you have the Walking Dead's budget.
And Greg Nicotero.
And Greg Nicotero doing it for you. Then actually some of the zombie stuff is quite hard to do. They did it quite well in 28 Days Later, although of course fast zombies are an entire conversation. No, we do not have fast zombies, Danny. But most zombies, or particularly in any of the knockoffs that you have, still look quite bad. I mean, I watched the Dawn of the Dead, which is the Zack Snyder, James Gunn scripted one. Their zombies don't look great in that. The makeup work's not amazing. Whereas if you, obviously, The Walking Dead, I mean, the first zombie that Rick comes across, the poor woman that he eventually sort of kills, I mean, that makeup is astonishing. So, and I thought that it's a different take. But yes, Fulci's zombies are very much of the earth. They are covered in worms. They are gray. They are green. They are disgusting. You know that if you touch them, your hand is going to go straight through the flesh. And I think that perfectly works for it. I think that perfectly works for the aesthetic he was going for. You can almost smell the movie is what I would say.
Definitely. You can smell the rot and the,
yes,
the sod and the, yeah, everything. So out of the two films, if someone was like, I have these two films and I want to watch one of them, which one should I watch?
Oh, definitely Zombie. Good Lord. Yeah. I mean, by a mile, it's an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. I feel that it bags a little bit in the middle. I think once they get to the island, they just spend a little bit too long prancing about and my attention drifted a tad, yep, until we get to the all out zombie warfare at the end. But it's a fairly nifty 90 minutes,
mm-hmm,
and there's plenty of, the attacks are quite well spaced, I felt. It's because sometimes you get like one thing at the beginning and then one thing at the end, and then the entire middle section has nothing going in it. Whereas the eye trauma is fairly early on in proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, definitely. I think in terms of, it's just a much more successful horror movie, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely go with Zombie 2. And it was actually written by Dardano Sacchetti, who was the guy that Argento was like, I'm not going to use your screenplay.
The one Argento binned off. Well, exactly, see, that's what happens when you see. Very timely in the current situation with the writers being on strike. This is what happens when you don't have good writers.
Exactly. So thank you so much for coming on and chatting Italian horror with me. So before we go, what is your favorite horror film?
See, this one is always quite difficult because it changes from time to time, but it is probably session 9.
Oh, interesting.
I feel like that's the one that has always stayed with me the most. It was one of those films where I'd always be like, have you seen it? And everyone would be like, no. And it's been sort of reclaimed in recent years. And there was a very beautiful remastered version of it put out a little while ago. And it's do not watch the director's cut under any circumstances. It is longer. It is slower. It explains too much. That's not, you don't need that. You don't need that. You just need to keep it to nice, short, sharp. People don't know what it is. It is about a group of builders and contractors, including randomly, and I have to, the star is David Caruso.
Love it.
Who are renovating sort of an old asylum, and they find a series of tapes, therapy tapes, sessions 1 to 9 with a very deranged patient, and things go very, very badly. And what I like about it is that it's very ambiguous and very interesting. And a close second is Lake Mungo, which also haunts the hell out of me.
One of my favorite found footage films ever.
And also the fact that that's the only film he's ever made, the director, and he appears to have vanished off the face of the earth.
Yeah.
I mean, he appears to be completely uncontactable. But yes, Lake Mungo, the sequence, the recovered mobile phone footage in which she sees her own fate is incredibly distressing. So yes, both of those.
Good choices. So where can people find you on social media?
Oh, goodness. You can find me on Twitter at Khaleesi, K-H-A-L-E-E-S-I _101. You can find me on www.thegeekgoddesses.com. Yeah, that's probably the main ones.
So that was my chat about Italian horror as I sit here in Italy with Naomi. Well, I'm not here in Italy with Naomi, but I sit here in Italy as I am recording this outro. And yes, we talked about Dario Argento's Cat and Nine Tails, one of his animal giallos, as well as Zombie 2, directed by Lucio Fulci. Let me know, what do you think about these two Italian horror films? Let us know on Twitter, @what_scream, as well as Instagram, @WhatAScream. And don't forget to like, review, subscribe on whatever platform you are listening to me on. And don't forget to stay horrific. A ciao!